This summer, the world's best tennis players are coming back to Cincinnati. The Cincinnati Open returns August 8th through the 23rd. Bigger than ever, with new fan spaces, incredible food, drinks, and entertainment all in one place. Voted Tournament of the Year by the players themselves. Community Weekend starts August 8th. Finals weekend, August 22nd and 23rd. Get your tickets now at cincinnatiopen.com.
The Last Word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Delighted to have for the Culture Club today Jane Casey, who is one of our most popular novelists at home and internationally. 16 crime novels for adults, 3 for teenagers. The Maeve Kerrigan series has been nominated for multiple awards. Jane Casey, thank you very much for being with us here on the programme.
Thank you so much for having me.
And tell us about the new novel, Everything She Didn't Say. Is this the first one you've set in Ireland?
It actually is. I know, it only took 19 books to get one that was set in Ireland.
And why so? Why did it take so long and why now?
Partly just my schedule, because I write this series that is ongoing. People are like, I don't want to say violent if I say I'm not doing a Maeve Kerrigan book in a particular year, but I really have to make space in the schedule for a book that isn't a Maeve. So it was really nice just to find the right moment for this book. And it felt like this was the right time to come home.
And what is it all about?
So it begins with two guards arriving into a small village in North Mayo, and they're there to interview a woman who was turned up covered in blood. She's not injured, but she's been staying in a cottage in the area, she says, with her best friend, and there's no sign of the best friend, and the cottage is covered in blood.
Tell us more.
Well, that's exactly what the guards say. So... And the whole thing is, it begins with them interviewing her, and then the more they hear from her, the more questions they have. So it's a very twisty story that goes a long way from County Mayo in the end.
Why Mayo? Why did you pick it?
It is where my mother grew up. So we have a family connection there. But also, I originally started thinking about writing this book during the pandemic. I have a very long lead time on anything I write. I always think for a long time before I put pen to paper. And I was thinking about being in Mayo. That was where I wanted to be. I was stuck in London. And it was the first time that I felt like I was an immigrant.
Did you spend a lot of time in Mayo growing up, sort of summer holidays and things?
We would go, yeah, we would go sometimes. My dad was from Dublin and he did not have the same emotional connection. Like once he was outside the pale, he started getting nervous. So he wasn't quite as keen on it as she was, but it was always her happy place and such a special place, like so different from anywhere else in the world. So I really wanted to write about it and to share it with like the international readers who read my books, some of whom have a big Irish connection and some of whom don't.
And tell us, why up to date have all your books been set outside of Ireland?
I think I was a little bit scared to write about Ireland, partly because I'm not living here full time. So I think I was a little bit worried that I would be too sentimental about it to write a good book. I think crime fiction should be holding a mirror up to society, but it should be like an accurate mirror. And I was worried that I would be just a little bit too kind and a little bit too rose-tinted about it. So I just really had to try and be truthful to what Ireland actually is and what Irish people are like. And hopefully that comes across in the book and it feels authentic.
Having grown up in Castleknock, I think, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. How long are you living outside of Ireland at this stage?
Well, I went to university in England. Then I came back for 5 years and then I went back in 2003. So I've pretty much been in London since 2003.
Why?
I got married. This is the terrible mistake that people make. I married an Englishman and his job keeps him in London. So we are there at the moment.
It wasn't a rejection of Ireland as such, was it?
Not at all. Although I think like having been at university in England, it was a bit of a different choice to make to go. Like it was going back to something that was more familiar than consciously leaving Ireland. It was more like, this is the right place for me to be at this point.
Did you not try, though, to come back about 7 or 8 years ago?
Yeah, I did. We came back as a family. I have two boys and we sold our house in London. We were fully committed to coming back. It was, I think, 2018. Just had the worst luck. It just did not work out for us at all. Everything went wrong. I think in any given year, you kind of accept that you might have two or three bad things happen to a greater or lesser extent. But it was like one thing after another after another. I had a book rejected for the first time ever. I'd written a book and my editor didn't like it. And so she was like, just, you know, go away and write something else. We'll have a year off. And that was my income for the year. And we were kind of counting on that to pay for the expenses of moving. The house that we were living in, the boiler was 110 years old and kept breaking down. So we had no hot water or heating. We were burgled. They stole all of the boys' Christmas presents. So it was just one thing after another. And no one was happy, least of all me, because I felt responsible because it was really my dream to come back. Like, everyone else was perfectly willing to go along with it, but it was for me that we had moved and I couldn't.
And you felt it was your fault. You'd put them into this situation for your ambition.
Very much so. Not even, you know, not for my ambition as much as for the thing that I had my heart set on. And so we kind of went back to where we had been, and it's taken us several years, many years really, to kind of fully settle back in again. But I think it was the right choice.
How long did you give it here in Ireland at that stage?
It was slightly less than a year. And there was just a one thing that happened that was kind of the last straw, which was my son, who was 8 at the time, was he was in school. And I'm not going to say which school it was, but he was sitting working at his desk and one of the big windows, you know, the school windows with 12 panes, the huge ones, the sash windows, fell out of its mounting and pinned him to his desk. So this very heavy window just landed on him.
He could have been killed.
Absolutely could have been killed. And when I got to the school, they didn't call me or anything. It was right at the end of the day and I went to pick him up and one of the other boys was coming out of the classroom and he said to his friend, "It's great that Edward's okay." And I was like, what does he mean, Edward's okay? But that was the first thing I heard was, he's okay. And then I saw his teacher, and his teacher was sheet white because he had seen it happen and thought, like, he was lifting the window off and thinking, what was he going to find, you know? So okay. that was when I thought maybe we should go.
Okay, right. That's a bit of a horror story. I can imagine why you did that. Okay, well, listen, thank you for coming in and telling us all of your choices for the Culture Club. We start by asking everyone to recall the first bit of music that they ever remember getting for themselves, buying, be it a single or whatever. You actually have a single that you remember getting on cassette.
That's right.
What is it?
It is Take On Me by A-ha.
Now, why that?
So I had seen the video for Take On Me, which is an iconic video. I think anyone who's seen it will remember it. And I must have seen it on Top of the Pops or something.
And what age would you have been?
I was 8. So, you know, there was no MTV. There wasn't, like, you couldn't see videos that easily. You couldn't watch them on YouTube or anything. But they'd made this incredible video. And I just loved everything about it. The story, the musicians, the music. And I just wanted to own that for myself.
Let's hear a little bit of A-ha, Take On Me. It's still a great track, isn't it?
Such a great track. I could honestly listen to it all the way through any time.
It's great when you have something from 8 years of age that you can still sort of stand over many, many years later.
I'm pleased I had good taste, you know?
And you've very good taste in all the other things that you have come up with us. So, favourite album, what are you going to recommend for us?
My favourite album, and this I took some thinking about, Radiohead, The Bends, is my absolute number one. It was the soundtrack to my university life. I went to Oxford and...
How come you ended up in Oxford?
I mean, good question. My sister had gone there. She sort of applied by chance and she had the most amazing time. And so I kind of thought, why not? I was 16. I wrote the entrance exam, didn't think anything of it, and was invited for an interview and went off and did it. And my parents were very much like, well, you're not going to get in, so don't worry about it. And then I did get in. So I ended up going over on my own. And
at 16?
No, they gave me a year out because I was really too young. Like, I'm looking back on it, I was such a baby. But even by the time I went over, I was still very young for my age, I think, compared to the other students. And it was such an amazing place. But the thing about it is that it's like a town as well as or a city, I should say, as well as the university. So it's all mixed together. And Radiohead were one of the local bands at the time. Now, they were already, I don't want to pretend to be like an early adapter, they were already very famous. They'd had Creep, had been...
Yeah, Pablo Honey would have been the first album. The Bends was the second album.
The Bends was the second one. And that was when they really went global, superstardom. But at the time, like, they still lived in the city. And you could easily run across Thom Yorke running in the park or... you know, just wandering down the high street. And I'm pretty sure the others were doing the same thing. They just weren't as recognisable as him. So it was lovely. They were like our band. And I remember going to this amazing party, the kind of party that you only go to when you're like 19 or 20, and sitting outside under the stars. And one of the boys had brought his guitar. And I think this must be the only time in history that a teenage boy brought a guitar to a party and was able to play it. And it worked. He sang an acoustic version of High and Dry, and everyone just sat and listened to it. And I think everyone fell in love with him a little bit and fell in love with the song. And we were all young and beautiful and everything was possible.
We don't have the acoustic version. We have from the album The Bends. This is Radiohead and High and Dry. One of the great Radiohead tracks, High and Dry. Actually, Jane, used to be we get a lot of people nominating from OK Computer on as their favourite Radiohead album and some of the later material. A lot of people are going back to the first couple of albums now and remembering them when they come on.
Yeah, and actually my 16-year-old listens to Radiohead and loves The Bends. And I haven't told him I love it as well because I think it will put him off if he knew that his mother liked this as well. But yeah, I think that's the great thing, that the music is still so good and so much so relevant to us now.
Okay, what's your favourite band though?
So my favourite band, this is a really tough question and I kind of went back and forth on how to answer it, but I'm going to pick a band called Hudson Taylor, who were, they are not a band anymore. They split up or they stopped playing music as Hudson Taylor in, I think, 2022. But they're two brothers and they are Irish and they are the most fantastic musicians. And they played, they had a few absolutely brilliant songs that they played. They did great cover versions. They were just fantastic musicians to listen to. And they just weirdly, like, I went through a phase of just seeing them a lot on the street in London. Now, London, you don't tend to run into people. It was like walking down Grafton Street. Like, I'd be like, yeah, here I am in Waterloo Station. There's one of Hudson Taylor. Here I am sort of walking through Carnaby Street. Oh, yeah, Hudson Taylor, just on the other side of the road. And it was like sliding doors. It was like everywhere I went, there they were. But they're great musicians. They're fantastic.
How did you come across them?
Do you know, I don't know. I think I must have heard one of their songs and then just got completely hooked on them. I actually don't remember the first one that I heard, but I know, like, I remember being in, I was somewhere for work. I was doing an interview, I think, and they were playing Hudson Taylor. And I was like, oh, this is them. And they were like, yeah, they were here last week. They thought I had amazing taste in music because I'd already heard of them.
Well, the track we're going to have from Hudson Taylor is called Chasing Rubies.
Take me away to some place else, 'cause I don't wanna see you with anybody else. And maybe I'm selfish, I don't know. I hardly know you, and I don't wanna let you go, and I don't wanna let you go. And this is not deja vu. Never met somebody like you. I like to tell you the truth. I hardly know you, and I don't wanna let you go, and I don't wanna let you go. Chasing rubies, chasing gold. I like to tell you before you're told.
What is it about that song you love so much?
It just sounds like home to me. I love it. It's so emotional and it's so full of yearning. They made the most beautiful video for it, which is all filmed in Connemara. And I just absolutely love it. I think I put it on every playlist that I had for every book that I wrote for about 5 years, just to have it come up when I was writing, just so that I could have a little.
Oh, do you always have music on in the background?
Oh, I always have music on. Yeah, I make a playlist. I like the mixtape thing. I do think that people who grew up in the era of mixtapes are very good at playlists and love it. And I always make them for the books. And just, I sometimes find if I'm working and it's not going that well and I stop and I just listen to the music for a couple of tracks, then I find my groove again and I can go back to where I should be with the book.
Best gig you were ever at?
This was kind of a funny one. It was the amazing Amy Mann, who doesn't tour that much in Ireland and the UK. I think she hasn't been over that much lately.
Last time I remember seeing Amy Mann would have been in Vicar Street around 20 years ago, and she was wonderful.
She's just the most incredible, I mean, funny, clever, incredible musician. I had heard her on the Magnolia soundtrack, which is, I think, what introduced her to a lot of people. And I remember sitting in the cinema and just sitting bolt upright when I heard she did all the music for that film. It is very
much... There's a bit of Supertramp in there as well, I think, isn't there?
Is there? Yeah, yeah, there probably is. Yeah. And I just thought she was incredible and listened to everything that she ever did. And my husband...
Back with Till Tuesday, the band she'd been with previously.
Absolutely. And she's the most inventive person and her lyrics are amazing, and my husband loves her music as well, so we went to see her together, and it was the funniest gig because it was like the atmosphere was like a a cult meeting. Like everybody who was there was completely reverent to listen to her and to be in the presence of greatness. And like you couldn't sing along because you had to listen to Amy Mann, because this is your one and only chance to see her live. And she was terrific.
Let's hear her singing Red Vines live.
They're all still on the honeymoon. Just read the dialogue balloon. Everyone loves you. Why should they not? And I'm the only one who knows the Disneyland's about to close. Cigarettes and red vines. Just close your eyes, 'cause baby, you never do know. And they'll be on the sidelines with my hands tied.
Ah, that is just wonderful. Amy Mann, what a fantastic choice to have for your favourite concert. Okay, we need to take a break. Jane Casey is with us. Her new novel is Everything She Didn't Say. We'll be back to get all her other choices, the non-musical choices, after this break. Welcome back to the Culture Club. Jane Casey is with us today. Her new novel is Everything She Didn't Say. So let's move away from the music. And when we asked you for a favourite movie, actor or director, you've gone for a movie, Gross Point Blank, which had Minnie Driver and John Cusack and Jeremy Piven in it. Tell us about this.
Oh, what an amazing film. It was John Cusack's sort of, I think he wrote it and was heavily involved in like putting it together. And it was such a brilliant, it's about, he plays a hitman who goes back to his high school reunion after 10 years, and he's basically disappeared for 10 years. No one knows he's a hitman, but he's just going to take the weekend off, go to his high school reunion, see the girl he should never have left behind, and hopefully find some happiness and peace. And it does not work out that way, inevitably. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a film. So it's so funny. It's so violent.
Smart.
Very intelligent. There's this fantastic love story. The banter is off the charts between him and Minnie Driver. He got his own teacher of martial arts to be in the film, and they have a fight scene, which is one of the best fight scenes that I have ever seen. It's extremely violent, and they were genuinely fighting, and I just love it.
Let's hear not that particular scene, but here is a clip when John Cusack's character, Martin Blank, returns to his hometown and reconnects with his childhood friend, Paul, played by Jeremy Piven.
So how's the family, man?
Oh, you didn't know? Of course you don't know.
I mean,
parents are divorced.
They got divorced?
Yeah, my dad's shacking up with this woman. She's like 20 years younger than him. She's like a biscuit older than me. It's ugly. My mom's making ceramic nightlights. Takes like the plain shells. And
how's your sister? Did you ever marry that guy, Kenny?
Kenny?
Yeah. I mean, did that ever work out?
Come on, man. He did 3 years at Joliet. They put one of those bracelets on him. Like a low jack, you know? They know where he is at all times. I think he's at Pizza Hut right now.
So let's not go there.
No.
Yeah. So you look good. You seem good.
Thank you. You may have, 10 years, man! 10! Where have you been for 10 years?
I freaked out, joined the army, went into business for myself. I'm a professional killer.
Oh, does that, do you have to do postgraduate work for that, or can you jump right in? I'm curious about that.
No, it's an open market.
Open market, yeah. That's good. Wow. 10 years, man! 10 years! 10 years! 10! 10 years! 10 years!
I freaked out. I joined the army. I worked for the government. I went into business with myself. I'm a professional killer. That's what I did.
Okay, well, can I join up?
Yes!
Gross Point Blank. That's a great choice. Tell us about your favorite play or musical theater show. What have you gone for?
Well, I went for one that I went to see a couple of years ago in London. Like, the good thing about living in London is that you do get good theatre, and if you can afford to go, and you can generally see very good actors doing very good plays. And I saw Cyrano de Bergerac, which is it was a reworking of it. It wasn't the kind of traditional one. It was written by a man called Martin Crimp, and it's all in rap, which sounds appalling, but it was one of the best things I have ever seen. And James McAvoy was the Cyrano. No funny nose. It was all the emotional trauma of feeling different. That is what comes across. And he is a very funny actor and a very physical actor. And there's one moment in it where he switches to do his job of trying to persuade the heroine to fall in love with his friend by pretending to be him. And the audience have been laughing and enjoying it. And it was like quite a raucous performance up to that point. And then he starts to woo her. And the whole theatre, which holds 800 people, I looked it up, the whole theatre was completely silent.
We have a clip of that.
You kiss my mouth. You bite my lip. You draw blood. You're on fire. You're on fire. The whole world shimmers, and I burn, and I burn with love.
Christian.
The whole world shimmers, and the night, and the sky, and your voice shimmers. I've no wit, I've no mind, I've no break, I've no self-control. I've no shame. I've no authority over myself. I can wait for hours for just one glimpse of you and then not speak to you at all. How can I speak? I can't speak to you. I can't speak. I can't stop speaking. I can't stop looking. I make you an object. I desire you. I write to you. I write for you. I tear up everything I ever wrote for you or about you. I burn myself alive for you. I worship you.
Can't believe somebody coughed in the middle of that.
I know, of all the times to have a cough. But yeah, I mean, it is the most extraordinary thing to watch someone just win over a whole theatre.
Favourite book or author? What have you gone for? I'm delighted you've managed to plump for one book and one author. Tell us, because this must have been difficult for you.
This was, well, it was and it wasn't, because there's one book in my, of the many millions of books that I have read that really stands out for me, and it's The Secret History by Donna Tartt, which is such a popular choice. I know among crime writers, a lot of us say it's our favourite, but...
But it is brilliant.
It's an incredible piece of work. Like, it breaks all the rules. It begins with the murder, and not only do you know who's dead, but you know who killed them. And then it spirals from there. I read it when it came out. So I remember hearing her on the radio, and I was on my way to school, and I thought I'd really like to read that book, and read it and thought, this has changed my life fundamentally. This is what I want to do with my life.
Let's hear a bit from the prologue of The Secret History, where we learn about the circumstances surrounding Bunny's death.
The snow in the mountains was melting, and Bunny had been dead for several weeks before we came to understand the gravity of our situation. He'd been dead for 10 days before they found him, you know. It was one of the biggest manhunts in Vermont history. State troopers, the FBI, even an army helicopter. The college closed, the dye factory in Hampton shut down, people coming from New Hampshire, upstate New York, as far away as Boston. It is difficult to believe that Henry's modest plan could have worked so well, despite these unforeseen events. We hadn't intended to hide the body where it couldn't be found. In fact, we hadn't hidden it at all, but had simply left it where it fell, in hopes that some luckless passerby would stumble over it before anyone even noticed he was missing. This was a tale that told itself simply and well. The loose rocks, the body at the bottom of the ravine with a break in the neck, and the muddy skid marks of dug-in heels pointing the way down. A hiking accident. No more, no less. And it might have been left at that, at quiet tears and a small funeral. Had it not been for the snow that fell that night, it covered him without a trace. And 10 days later, when the thaw finally came, the state troopers and the FBI and the searchers from town all saw that they had been walking back and forth over his body until the snow above it was packed down like ice.
And that made you want to be a crime writer.
Certainly did. That is Donna Tartt herself reading.
Is it?
Yeah, she recorded the audiobook, which I am very surprised by as well. But yeah, she recorded it. So that is her voice.
It's such a great book. Okay, television. What did you grow up watching?
Well, I mean, you know, sometimes I wonder, how did I end up becoming a crime writer? And then I answer a question like this and I think, actually, everything that I watched on TV when I was a child was basically crime inflected. We were completely hooked on things like Remington Steele, Knight Rider, MacGyver. Magnum P.I. was incredibly influential. And of course, Heart to Heart.
Let's play a little bit of Heart to Heart with Robert Wagner, Stephanie Powers and Lionel Stander in one of the infamous epilogues that they used to have on Heart to Heart.
Well, I thought the play came off really well.
Considering.
Considering what?
Considering I could hardly get the lines straight.
Oh, I don't think anybody noticed.
I hope not.
You know, darling, the community players are about to schedule their new season.
Oh, no. Mm-mm.
No?
Not me.
Oh.
The closest I'm going to get to a theater is a seat in Fifth Row Center.
Well, you're no fun at all. Max! What is that costume?
You like it?
It's a little startling. Are you going to a costume party?
Nah. I thought I'd try out for that Shakespeare group. They're doing Hamlet. What do you think? To be or not to be? That is the question.
Believe me, if that's the question, you don't want to know the answer.
It was so corny, wasn't it?
Oh my God. I don't know how they did a take without laughing, honestly. They were obviously complete professionals and so they could do it very well. But it was so glamorous to me as a child.
Yeah, these were this rich couple and he was their butler, chauffeur type, wasn't he, in the restaurant, and they would go out and investigate murders and always within the hour get the answer.
There was always a murder and they had a dog called Freeway who had a very important part to play by running in and yapping occasionally and then running out again. But yes, it was just the four of them really who solved the crimes.
And what sort of things do you like at present?
I'm just obsessed with Widow's Bay.
It's terrific.
I've just finished it and I just think what an amazing, brilliant idea. Like I think they said it's what would happen if the mayor from Jaws was in charge in a Stephen King book. And that is exactly what it feels like.
I'm only on episode 7, so don't give anything away.
But no
I'm looking
spoilers.
Forward to it. It's fantastic. I see you have Slow Horses and The Pit as well.
I do. I really enjoy. I mean, I used to love watching Noah Wiley in pretty much anything. So seeing him in The Pit, delighted. And Slow Horses is just like, I think it's the dream for a crime writer. Like Mick Herron.
Who's done The Culture Club here as well, actually.
He is so pleased with it because it's so true to his books. So yeah, amazing.
We're out of time, so I need to quickly get you to tell me a buried treasure.
My buried treasure is slightly a funny one. It's I think it's been a bit overlooked, but I love the recording that Andrew Scott did during the pandemic of Derek Mahon's beautiful poem, Everything is Going to Be All Right. And I think it maybe didn't land with people at the time because we were all a bit cynical and fed up and locked in. But I go back and listen to it now and then, and I think it's so beautiful.
Let's hear a little bit of it.
How should I not be glad to contemplate the clouds clearing beyond the dormer window and a high tide reflected on the ceiling? There will be dying. There will be dying. But there's no need to go into that. The poems flow from the hand unbidden, and the hidden source is the watchful heart. The sun rises in spite of everything. And the far cities are beautiful and bright. I lie here in a riot of sunlight, watching the day break and the clouds flying Everything's going to be all right.
Andrew Scott reading Everything is Going to Be All Right by Derek Mann. Final choice of Jane Casey. Thank you so much for joining us on the Culture Club. The new novel is Everything She Didn't Say.
The Last Word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.